social statement on peace. What we've done this week, and now most of you today, not all of you, but most of you aren't, I'd say half of you are new, right, to this session. What we've been doing is looking at, why the church makes social statements, that are the process of doing that. What are the sources that go into a social statement? How do we figure out what to say about a particular issue, and how we use the most important source is the Bible, but we also use our Lutheran theology and confessions, and of course we reflect on the situation that confronts us in the world and what it is that we need to speak to, so the church can carry out its mission, in this case to be a peacemaker in the world. Yesterday we ended up, we had some discussion about just war, and we're going to come back to that today. Bye. But we ended up, I think, with an affirmation, the small group of us that were here yesterday, that the ELCA, of course, Lutherans have not been what we call a historic peace church, or they haven't been a pacifist church like the Quakers, the Brethren, the Mennonites. We were looking actually yesterday at the Augsburg Confession, and what it has, a little bit that it has to say about war and peace in Article 16, and the way the Augsburg Confession is written, it not only affirms what Luther and his colleagues believe, but it also condemns certain other people, and condemned in Article 16 are the Anabaptists who teach, against war and so on. So Lutherans have not been a historic peace church, but we agreed at the end of our session that within the framework of our church, that we're united as the body of Christ, and that we agreed that there was room both theologically and in terms of Christian love and our being united through Christ, there's room in our church for both people who are against all participation in war and people who see that sometimes war and the use of military force may be necessary. And that really where our Lutheran confessions lead us on this is to an ethic of responsibility, that we're to be responsibly involved in the world. That's the most important thing. We're not to stand back and not participate. Luther was very big on our being active in all the stations of life, in our family, in our in government, that it was legitimate and morally right that Christians participate in government. And so that ethic of responsibility may lead different people to different conclusions about what to do in a specific situation, and that we as a church can embrace those different conclusions. I think that's where we ended up. That we can have our pacifists, some of whom have been very active against war, and we can also have people who, and probably the church as a whole, will tend more toward the just war. Under certain circumstances, there are times when force may need to be used, although that's always a last resort. Then we're going to come back to some of those criteria about just war related to Bosnia. What I want to do today is really try to talk about the situation in Bosnia, recognizing that none of us, including me, are experts on this situation. I think in the and when I think of the Vietnam War and of course our country's intense involvement in that, we had many years to sort of learn a lot about the situation. We haven't had so long to learn about Bosnia, and these countries are new. I mean, even the idea of these five independent states that used to form the former Yugoslavia, and probably to begin with, we knew very little about Yugoslavia, and now we know even less, probably not even the names of all five of these states that used to be Yugoslavia. But to just give us a little, and I do not pretend in any way to be an expert in this at all, but to give us a little recap of, what led up to the current situation, we all know about the dissolution of communism in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union in the early 90s, both very late 80s and early 90s. And one of the results of this in Yugoslavia, not only in Yugoslavia, but we also can think of the Baltic states like Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, was a resurgence of people's quest for self-determination in their own states, their own little ethnic states. And so in Yugoslavia, the Bosnian, what had been, you know, these were not new. If we had a map, it would be nice, but these were not sort of new formations of people. These were old kinds of areas, sort of like states of Yugoslavia, that the republic, whatever it's called, the Yugoslavia, was laid over the top of all these, and the conflict was suppressed. But when that the power of that state was weakened, then these old rivalries and old sense of independence resurfaced, and so you ended up with Bosnia Herzegovina, which was we just call Bosnia, which included not just one ethnic group, included Christians and Muslims. You had Serbia, which in a way was sort of the inheritor of the capital of the former Yugoslavia, Belgrade, and so sort of saw itself as the big cheese in the bunch. Croatia, Slovenia, and Macedonia. And then the Serbians were not real happy with this, and in fact the United States initially really wanted to preserve the territorial integrity of Yugoslavia, and so in a way the Serbs read this as a green light to begin military conflict to try to move toward restoring some of the area of former Yugoslavia. So that's sort of, anybody have anything to add to that in terms of sort of a basic beginning of this? Does that ring true to what people have read in the news?
I guess when I thought of Yugoslavia, I didn't necessarily think of Muslims before.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't either.
I just found, actually my husband found this morning, because I knew nothing really of the history of the Balkans, and he found in the library here this book this morning. Well, of course, I didn't have time to read it all. this is very interesting. I'll leave it on the table afterwards, but one of the quick things I found out, which of course is logical, but the area was under the control of the Ottoman Turks, for a really long time, as much of that part of the world was, just like the Middle East was too. And Islam was probably brought in by the Muslim. Of course, Turks were Muslim.
Here you go.
And the Muslims have not been a majority group in all of Yugoslavia, because it's the Orthodox Church. There are more Christians than Muslims in Yugoslavia as a whole, but there are areas where Muslims predominate. I don't want to spend a lot more time on the history, because partly because we probably don't know enough to say a lot more about it. But what I'm going to do next is share a quote with you from an article by New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis. This column appeared in the New York Times, it was last a week ago today, and was in the Seattle PI earlier this week. And
was it in there?
This was in the Seattle PI on, so it was the day we went to Stahik, and it was the 17th. That's how come we got the papers. It's hard keeping up to date on the news up there, but maybe we don't want to. But he says that the West's worst moral and political disaster, he opens the article and it's headlined, Bosnia, Moral and Political Disaster for the West. He says the West's worst moral and political disaster since the Nazis is coming to a climax. Now, we may or may not agree with that. I mean, I'm not sure I do, when I look at things like the extermination of so many people in Cambodia in the 70s, millions of people killed and so forth. However, it is a major, we could agree it's a major moral and political disaster. And I think what we want to look at today some is why it is, and then what stance do we take as a church about this? And what do we personally think? And I especially want to get a little later on to the question of, you know, possible military intervention and what we think about that, and would that be justifiable? I also want to, before we start, I want to ask you folks a question, but I also want to read something from this book, because I was skimming over it this morning. And then I'm going to ask you, what date do you think this was written? If you smell the book, you might be in the whole book. As Soviet power wanes in the Balkans, and old divisions are appearing once more, we may expect a return of discord and possibly of mass violence as well. Today, the Soviet effort to impose unity on the Balkans by force is clearly failing. After the disappearance of communism, whenever that day of deliverance may come, unity will have to be achieved through the free consent of all. But as the bloody experience of the Balkans in this century attests, free consent will be no easy thing to achieve. 1964.
Going back about 50 years or so, World War II, I can't remember too much about it, but I know there were two groups in Yugoslavia, and one of them, I guess, communist group, and there's another group of partisans, and the United States more or less backed one group and not the other, and I can't remember the details about, but there were just two main groups who were fighting World War II, and Tito was ahead of one of them. I can't remember the name of the other guy ahead of the other one, but I think the non-communist one was doing the best job of fighting the enemy, but we didn't back that side. And I don't know if, you know, what the background of those two groups were. If it was based on religion or what?
I don't know the answer to that. And I know my husband was saying this morning that, you know, there were also, like, he spoke of there were a couple major massacres that happened too, like the Croats. I'm trying to think of people they massacred, but there was a major internal to the people there there was the sort of political, you know, communist maybe versus, you know, more free enterprise kind of people that going on, but there also, I'm sure, underlying that was still this kind of ethnic regional rivalry that seems to have been part of that region for a really long time.
I guess I think of that a lot because I'm from the Washington, North Idaho area. And as long as I can remember, North Idaho and Eastern Washington have wanted to secede and be their own state because they're basically agricultural. And those people who live in Boise and those people who live in Seattle don't understand us. Those people get all the money for everything. They get all the highways, they get all the state money, and they don't understand us. However, I have never heard anybody in Spokane or any place in North Idaho say, we have to wipe those people out.
Yeah.
I mean, we say they're dumb, stupid, rotten, and weird, but we never say, we have to kill them. And so there's real, obviously, some real basic other stuff that goes on when to be safe. And I was a year ago attending a Church of England church, and they added to their prayers at the church, and we prayed it every single day. May the Christians not have to feel that they must murder the Muslims to be safe.
Right. Yeah. It's and of course, if you have a history where there have been, and of course this points us to some of the legacies of the current conflict, when you have a history of like massacres and you know, wiping out and so forth. I mean, the legacy of that goes on from generation to generation. Let's spend a few minutes sharing what is it about this conflict over the last year or so that's come to us through the news and so on. What has been a concern? What has been upsetting to you? Think of particular, you know, news stories or things about this conflict that have made you upset or concerned. What are some of the issues?
The little kids that are being slaughtered.
It's complete villages.
And you know, just
number of civilian casualties.
On the rapes.
Yep.
Inhumanity to man.
Others?
I think one of the things that you alluded to, Carol, is one of the things that's always been interesting to me is why we're so upset about this as opposed to, like you said, Cambodia, Namibia, El Salvador. In any war, the civilian casualties to military casualties are 8-1. Mm-hmm. And this is no different. This is no worse than any other war.
Mm-hmm. Well, we were the perpetrators in
here. Yeah, but I think what's unsettling about this one is that these people look like us. Mm-hmm. A lot of them do, anyway. And it's also in Europe. And I think that gets scary because when Europe becomes unbalanced, it's different than when Cambodia becomes unbalanced.
Good point.
It scares us economically.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why the press is on it as opposed mm-hmm. to some of these other parts of the world.
Right. But we haven't seen this.
Part of this, I suppose, too, is that technology-wise, we get pictures. We can have pictures almost daily of conflict, which mm-hmm. even a few years ago, or where people are hidden and fighting in, in South America, it was probably a lot more difficult, technology-wise, to put this in front of the people as dramatically as
it's been done. It's kind of where the press chooses to go to.
El Salvador, we
didn't see anything in El Salvador, and I was in Nicaragua during the war there, and there was very little press up here, and that's a 6-hour plane flight.
Interesting.
Uh-huh.
They claim it's a religious war. They're after the Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
It seems really difficult when a leader will make a speech that appears to accept a solution, goes back, has a conference, and comes out and says, "I didn't mean that."
Right. What would you say? Would you say that? Yeah, the.
I don't know.
Ambivalent. Going back on agreement. It's going back in agreements. That's also, haven't we been moved by? I mean, these pictures from Sarajevo of the hospitals, the lack of medical care and food getting in and so on.
We just saw Sarajevo a few years ago in the Olympic Games.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
It was beautiful. See the way it used to be.
Relate to it.
Right.
I couldn't believe it was the same Sarajevo for a while.
I couldn't either. The Seattle Times ran the same headline they ran when World War I started.
They did.
Yeah. Murder in Sarajevo.
I think the thing that gets that's getting our population the maddest about this, though, is just that this, as he said, technology has brought the injustice of war into our living rooms. We saw some of that in Vietnam and stuff, but we haven't seen people who have just been caught up helplessly. Mm-hmm. In war. I mean, it happens in every war there's ever been.
Right.
But this is one where we've really seen the injustice of war on the civilian population.
And we don't have any political or economic really involvement there like we have had in South America and so forth. There's always been somebody in the government that would really lose if they got their freedom. So in this one, there isn't any economic.
Right, well, that's partly why we have not intervened, and of course, I think another thing that's going on is that with people and they're being concerned and upset is a sort of sense of powerlessness about it. Wherever you stand sort of politically on the use of force or whatever, that, the military is saying, well, this can't be, and this relates to one of the just war criteria we look at, this couldn't be a winnable war, there's nothing we can do, really, the lack of partly because it's so complex that the lack of clear idea of how non-military means could be used that we haven't really been successful in pressuring the Serbs and just the sense of impotence. And I think that really relates to the Europe part too, is because you know, it's one thing, like you say, in the third world, but, you know, I mean, Yugoslavia's way been in the second world, but now it is part of Europe. And, you know, what about NATO? I mean, you know, like we're, you know, I mean, they were not part of NATO, they were part of the Warsaw Pact, but that this is awfully close to home to have things close to centers of military and political power in the world to have things going this haywire, right? I mean, isn't that sort of, I think, the feeling that a lot of us have.
You can read, I heard a while ago, you know, one day you would read how smart we were to be staying out of this mess, and the next day you read the next article that tells how terrible we are because we aren't over there participating.
Yeah.
The media itself, created different pictures from day to day.
Right.
And, you can see how confused, in a sense, we are about that situation.
Right.
Well, this also was affected by our local or domestic political differences, and it was the lack of action by the previous administration in Bosnia was used as a political argument. But one thing that bothers me is I wonder if we're getting accurate pictures from the media, because there's so much politics in everything that you read. And of course, we know that the Russians backed the Serbs. And so we can't go too far against, we don't want to get in a dispute with Russia. So that's always a political consideration. And I think that perhaps the media is sympathetic to the Muslims, because it seems like everything we read is what the Serbs do to the Muslims. But of course, the Muslims say it's the Muslims are just as bad and committing just as many atrocities and all. Well, actually, I read everything I can about it, and I was confused.
He was just right.
That wasn't the beginning.
Yeah. No, I've been sort of clipping articles the last couple weeks and trying to sort of get them up to speed on it. And there are so many different points of view. And like right now, one of the things I've seen happening and is the growing divergence between like where the UN is in terms of the UN commanders and, you know, the US and some of the US media. Like, I think right now, that some of the stuff I've read is pretty, not openly critical, but pretty dubious about that the UN has really been tilting toward the Serbs pretty strongly, and that's been coming up. In terms of thinking of the legacy of this, or what failures it points to, I'm starting to get into that a little bit. Anthony Lewis talks about, he mentioned that going back to the previous administration, I mean, he, because he's a liberal and I'm sure did not support the Bush administration, but he says that in 91, when the U.S., through Baker and so on, said, you know, we really support the territorial integrity of Yugoslavia, which sounds like on the surface, a pretty legitimate thing to say. I mean, we don't, as a nation, usually go out supporting disintegration of nations. However, the way this was read by the Serbian government was sort of as a green light to give their support to the Bosnian Serbs who were, trying to take over Bosnia and Herzegovina. But he also then looks at the failure of the European community. I don't like you to make too many copies here, but I'll read a little bit of this. The European community, that expression of hope for, he's pretty sarcastic, that expression of hope for a united Europe proved unable to respond to disaster on its doorstep. For that failure, the community has already suffered a profound loss of public faith. The national politicians of Western Europe showed all the backbone of an amoeba. John Major of Britain gave a passable imitation of Neville Chamberlain. Well, he's scathing of this. I mean, he is really. And I don't know how many are you familiar with Anthony Lewis? And he's written a lot on the Middle East, and he
he's quite, when he becomes impassioned about something, I mean, he's really impassioned about it. But then he critiques NATO. Says, here's NATO. We've poured vast resources for 40 years to keep the peace in Europe. It cannot summon the will to act. Its leaders devoted themselves to inventing disguises for cowardice. And then he doesn't say Clinton either. I mean, he points to, you know, that Clinton, Clinton's administration also, you know, has been weak in the situation. And then he says the UN has suffered grievous wounds. Its peacekeeping function, which has proved valuable in many places, was so grossly misused in Bosnia that peacemakers became handmaidens to genocide. Which, you know, may be a little overstated, but certainly the role of the UN has not been... I mean, things could have been worse, we could argue, but also the UN has not at all been able to act in any way that has prevented, prevented the deaths that have occurred. Do people know how many deaths have occurred? Yeah, I read somewhere today, 200,000. And about, let's see, in Sarajevo, it's been about 12,000. Let's talk a little bit more about what do you think, any more comments about what do you think the legacy of this is going to be, the cost of the situation, just the cost, the human cost, the moral cost for the world community.
I think one other thing we haven't listed up there is I think all of us feel is kind of a guilt. I mean, I think that those of us who were raised in a generation after World War II, think, you know, my God, why didn't somebody do something about the Jews being deported and incinerated?
Mm-hmm.
And you get the feeling that, you know, if you don't do something here, the next generation is going to say, what are you people?
Right.
I mean, we got a Holocaust going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And we're wringing our hands, like he says, wondering what we ought to do. And it's happening right in front of our eyes, and history's kind of repeating itself. And the rest of the civilized world isn't lifting a finger.
Right, and of course the legacy of that is still with us in terms of a number of issues, but especially related to the Middle East, it's really in a lot of ways a legacy of the West's failure related to that.
But I think balanced against that is, you know, how many civil wars do you want to get involved in?
Yeah.
How many American lives do we want to lose
that
might not solve the problem? There's that pressure too.
Right.
Or can we think of any sort of a solution that would be a solution, not just putting the lid back on?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think I want to come to that right now. I just want to say one more thing about the legacy of this. I think, you know, he's pointing to the weakening of what you would call institutions of security and order. I mean, the weakening of the UN, the weakening of NATO and the European community, which will have an effect in terms of their authority to deal with other conflicts. It's also possible this may spread. You know, there's been the worry about Macedonia and, you know, what may happen there. And then, of course, the whole impact of this in the Muslim world. I mean, you know, we have to understand that right now, with the rise of Islamic fundamentalism worldwide, and the appeal of that people, that the failure of the West in this circumstance certainly fuels that and makes that, you know, makes it harder to find, you know, to build tolerance and so on because of the failure of the West to really do anything.
The refugees going into Germany is kind of unsettling too. I think that all these refugees going into Germany and some of these southern European countries is making right-wing voices in Germany stronger.
Mm-hmm.
They're
right.
Sick and tired of refugees, there's no jobs, there's resources that we can put into taking care of these people.
Right.
And right-wing voices are on the rise again in Germany, and that's a little scary to the rest of the thing, to the rest of us.
Well, coming to the question about sort of where we're at now and what, you know, what might work, as far as I can tell from reading whatever papers are available here, where things are at right now, and add to this if you know anything more, is the parties involved are very near to agreement on this partition plan for the three sort of zones in Bosnia with UN supervision and UN control of Sarajevo for a period of up to 2 years. That's one thing that the Bosnian Muslim president has agreed to this, and I'm not sure about the Bosnian Serbian leader, but I mean it's getting very near to agreement. That's one track. The other track is that all the sort of pieces have been put in place, like for airstrikes. The idea was that the U.S. under NATO, with UN approval, would launch airstrikes. This was like about a couple weeks ago. But if these Serbs did not withdraw from these mountains around Sarajevo, well, the Serbs have mostly withdrawn at this point. Only there's a couple hundred Serbs left. But the plan for the airstrikes and the basis of them would have been they're not withdrawing. Plan for the airstrikes is now, according to yesterday's PI and through the UN, everything been totally sort of set up so that it can, you know, happen. So that's sort of a parallel thing. Now, whether such airstrikes would then be approved for implementing this plan, you know, or whatever, that's a question I can't answer. But on the one hand, they're moving toward this negotiated settlement, and there is this plan for airstrikes to enforce Serbian withdrawal from the siege of Sarajevo. Now, but that's a really fluid situation, and as you pointed out, and others have pointed out, many times agreements have been made, and they're here today, gone tomorrow, you know. Even if this situation, this plan went into effect, the odds against it are enormous, I think. And this is, I think, the dilemma that we face. I wanted to read you a few quotes from a New York Times article of, this was at least a week ago, more than a week ago. This is basically a, mostly quoting Muslims, Muslim perspective, that what Muslims are hoping for is comprehensive arms strikes, the lifting of the international arms embargo against the Muslims, rolling back Serbian gains to preserve a unified Bosnia, and that they believe they will be saved only when the Serbs come to the negotiating table as the vanquished rather than the victors. Now, this is prior to the agreement of the Muslims to this plan. However, I would still guess that this is probably the feeling of most people. Here's a quote. It's very simple, said, I can't pronounce his name, but the commander of the 5th Corps of the Bosnian Army. He said, for Bosnia, there can be no peace without a military solution. And then later, a partitioned peace, this is not a quote for him, but this is in the article, a partitioned peace, which is now what we're now talking about, these three areas, with the Serbs getting the lion's share of Bosnia will likely be no peace at all. The UN has already pledged tens of thousands of troops, including American soldiers, to enforce a negotiated settlement. The presence of peacekeepers will do little to smother Bosnia's raging ethnic hatred. So,
then there was an article shortly thereafter about the fact that the Muslims were hoping that they wouldn't withdraw, so that the U.S. would start to go in there and with their strikes.
Right.
And then
right. And that should only, right, that only Serbs sort of chastened by some military defeat would be willing to make any kind of decent political settlement. Well, so we're really, you know, placed sort of what you call between a rock and a hard place, because here's this, you know, negotiated agreement that, you know, may well bring some short-term relief in terms of casualties, right? I mean, this may be, you know, we'll get the UN, you know, start. But it's real hard to be hopeful about this being any kind of long-term solution. So it's, I find it hard to get very enthusiastic about this plan. What can we do? What's the alternative? I mean, do any of you think that there would be hope to really roll back the Syrian and this is very important. The Middle East, no, the Serbian gains on the last year.
The one thing that I've noticed in an article that I read a couple weeks or so back, it seemed like the Muslims
we're making progress in fighting back against the Serbs. And a lot of the Muslim leaders would like to defer his arms.
Right.
And they'd like to continue us, and they could be disturbed. Mm-hmm. And, but I can't see us going that far to arm them. But that would be an alternative. Yeah. If they're going to keep on fighting anyway, they might as well fight it out and eat people ground. And then that might bring the Serbs to make a more equitable solution to the whole problem. That's pure speculation, but I can't see us going in there.
You're doing that, arming them, yeah.
No, I can't see us doing that. I can't see us sending any troops in there. Yeah. And if we were to start bombing the Serbs, well, we'd be taking sides. And in order to do it successfully, you have to have some ground observers, and there'd be somebody from America getting killed. They'd be in harm's way. And well, even we've gone so far as we have some token troops in Macedonia. Well, what if it goes on into Macedonia? What are we going to do? And as far as the UN peacekeeping forces, well, they're not sufficiently armed. They can't even protect a convoy of food and medical supplies. So, what good would they do? I don't see any real solution.
Yeah, it's
obvious. I would like to step back and say we know a lot of things about what doesn't work. We know partition is not a wonderful solution. It's never worked any place we've ever tried. So if we could step back, how would we do a problem solving? You know, if this were a basic problem solving, how would we start out? Well, we might do a needs assessment. So if we went back and really laid out the needs, I'm not sure I'm even familiar enough to know what they, I mean, I hear these people talk and I think they've got a horrendous need for pride. Okay, well, that's human, I can understand that. So how do you meet a pride need? And then you try and build into your solution ways you need pride. They've got terrific economic needs. How do you build in that? And there were many things I liked about when Henry Kissinger used to do negotiations for us, because he sometimes used our very remarkable resources to give people things they perceived as needing that I would never have thought of. You know, I mean, kind of tea house at the August Moon, it would never dawn on me that you needed a tea house to feel good about yourself. We have the resources to give you a tea house, but I never would have thought to give you that. And
yeah, I think it's difficult for us to have that discussion because of our lack of knowledge about that in a way. And I think it's a really important discussion. But I think the dilemma that faces us right now is, you know, do we think that some kind of interim solution? I would pose the question this way: do we think that our country's involvement, this would be sort of a question for debate, our country's involvement through the UN in enforcement of this emerging plan is, at least at the current time, something that will achieve some goals that we feel are valuable, and which would be diminishing loss of human life, buying some time for some more longer-term solutions. I mean, do we think that that this current partition plan is worth supporting with our own government resources? The sub-question would be: would that include the use of military force to, if this plan goes into effect? Do we believe that through international auspices that we should be part of the enforcement of this emerging partition plan? What
what would be the, you know, what would be the possible benefits of it? I'm sure that stays open.
What's the alternative? Yeah. To simply do nothing like we've been doing. So I say, perhaps it's better than doing nothing. Perhaps it will bring about peace for a period of time, to the point where maybe somewhat more of a reasonable settlement can be achieved. If. But criticism, I think, of the majority of the public has been, at least because of what we've seen, and maybe we don't fully understand, is that, man, here we sit. We haven't lifted a finger. But of course, what we do then, we turn on him to blame the UN for doing such a lousy job and backing away.
But when we finally say, okay, the rest of the world says the United States must do something, and the United States goes ahead and does something in good faith, everybody's mad at them. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you get no thanks for at least trying. We're the villain over there for one side or the other constantly.
Well, you know, I think this is maybe a little, I know what you're saying in terms of some of the past issues, but I think the situation is a little different. I mean, one of the things that Lewis is saying here is that the European community, and partly we've created the situation, is not going to act without strong U.S. leadership on something. And that's just, you know, I mean, we could criticize the Europeans for that. Well, why can't you take care of your own backyard, you know? But in fact, we have built and relished the role as the leader of NATO. So, you know,
grand savior.
You know, so, you know, for better or worse, we are in a situation of being leaders. And so then with leadership comes responsibility. Maybe something to do right now would be, because we don't have much more time here, but I really would like to look at this Chilstrom letter. And even though it's a little dated, if you could turn to the third page, again, this is sort of related to the situation of 3 or 4 months ago. But what Chilstrom is trying to do here is to look at the situation and whether or not military intervention should be considered in Bosnia, using the criteria of what we call the just war doctrine. So using these criteria to look at the Bosnian situation. Now, a few things have changed since he wrote this letter, but a number of the things are still the same. And these may help us think about whether it is legitimate for our country to be prepared to use military intervention, if need be, to support a particular aim. The first one, justifiable cause. You know, do you think that there's a justifiable cause in this situation? He says to stop the systematic slaughter and provide settlement for peaceful settlement of the conflict. But we can also ask in terms of cause, well, what about, would a justifiable cause be an enforcement of this UN negotiated plan? Would a justifiable cause be maintaining territorial integrity of Bosnia? What do you think? You think that there's a cause, a justifiable cause, that would justify military intervention? Or you're uncertain? No.
No. There's a, well, maybe it's just another Vietnam type thing, a no-win situation. And, I think that eventually, if we're going to continue to participate in the UN, that the only possibility of the UN being a peacekeeping force anywhere is they're going to have to beef up their mm-hmm. armament mm-hmm. and all, and so that
become more of a world army kind of thing.
Right, and unless we go that route. Well, in many situations, they're going to be powerless, and it seems like every time we get like Somalia, when the U.S. troops pull out and the the UN takes over, they have problems right away because they don't have the armament.
But that's, one thing I want to do is say that relates more to number six in this criteria than it does to number one. You can have, this is why these things are all interrelated. You can have a just cause, but if you don't have the military power to accomplish your goal, then you do not have a very good, reasonable chance of success, which is number six. And I think that the military's reluctance on Bosnia has been very much related to number six. The cause may be just, and, our intention may be right, but, we don't have, a snowball.
You don't have an easy objective.
How much does it really fix the problem?
Well, this is,
because the Austrians tried to fix the Serbs.
Right.
And the Russians have tried to fix the Serb. I mean, lots of people have militarily tried to, you spank the child so that the child will learn.
Right.
All the child learns is the big guy gets to spank. So the next time, they want to be the big guy. I mean, what lesson do you learn from this particular military action?
Mm-hmm.
That the United States owns expensive weaponry. And if you owned that expensive weaponry, you could have won.
Mm-hmm.
You would have been right. You know what?
Right.
So the alternative is to sit there and let them kill themselves.
Well, yeah, I mean, what I want to, that's the conclusion. What I want us to do is to just sort of go through these quickly, and we don't have a lot more time, but that's the conclusion of sort of looking at these different things. But cause, how many, just show of hands, how many people, just related to this one criteria, think that there probably is, let's say probably a justifiable cause for military intervention in Bosnia, not related to chance of success, but just for the reason, for doing it. How many people would
by
the United States?
Under UN auspices and
as they're currently programmed to do, or are you making it a much bigger thing and saying we'll win it with everything we have if we
say the question of the enforce. If the question were about enforcement of this agreement, which appears to be emerging, how many?
We already have the UN there,
mm-hmm.
and we have military UN people.
Yeah. More observers than more than.
Well, that's because the UN doesn't have an army.
That's why you're
so with the ambiguity of this, how many would lean toward there's probably a justifiable cause for some, some level of military intervention under the UN plan if the Serbs try to renege on this agreement. Let's put it that way. How many would renege on the agreement?
Yeah.
Say if we get this agreement and then the Serbs try to go back on it. Okay, that's about two-thirds of us, I think. But okay. All right, legitimate authority. This addresses the question of who is it that makes the decisions about this. And where we're at now is that it's sort of related to this airstrike issue, it's the UN approving NATO command with US troops under NATO command to do the air intervention, so it would be under an umbrella of UN authority. Do people think that's a legitimate authority to? How many people would think that if we were going to do military intervention, that's a legitimate authority?
The multinational.
The UN.
Well, when it's authorized by the United Nations, then they point to the U.S. and say, "You do it."
Right, that's another issue, but it's a question of the authority. It's a little different than we had in the Gulf War, right?
Mm-hmm.
Gulf War was multinational, but wasn't under UN. It was a coalition put together by the U.S. This is going much more through the direct channels. Like this whole the PI story yesterday was quoting Boutros Rali on the UN. How they process this whole thing on air intervention if the Serbs don't withdraw. So it's much more the UN than the being the umbrella rather than just the US. Okay, last resort. That's always related to any conflict, a huge question.
and that some people think that torpedoes the whole just war criteria, because it's almost, you know, because when is the last resort? Some people think the use of force in the Gulf War was the last resort to get the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and a lot of people think it wasn't. I, for one, don't think it was, but other people say, well, no, it was. But I think, do people see other options at this point? I mean, does anybody have, you know, does anybody feel that we really haven't explored sufficiently diplomatic channels on this? I mean, one thing, I guess we have to wait to see how this plan goes, right? If this plan comes into being, even though it may be doomed to failure. There may be a miracle, we never know.
Well, thinking of what Chisholm is saying, too, that we can't possibly stop with just the plan that's a stopgap at this point.
Right.
That helping or having those people help to understand what their needs really are and to go from there, because this certainly isn't enough to solve it.
Right. Well, and related to that, since, you know, two of you brought that up, what would that mean for our own country's involvement? Say we had, you know, say this plan goes forward and we have the UN sitting in Sarajevo and keeping the different partitioned parts from fighting and stuff. What would it take to work on these longer term issues? How would we do that? I mean,
it's a double education process, and what a tough time we have in our own country educating.
But what are some things? I mean, economic investment, redevelopment, commitment of maybe of the State Department to ongoing negotiations between the parties that we would help facilitate, or that we would, you know, try to participate with the European Economic Community and maybe negotiation of long-term issues. I mean, this all means commitment of resources, energy, time, you know. Warren Christopher is working on the Middle East. He's working, you know, they can sort of only do like maybe one and a half things at a time, you know. It's a question. I mean, it's like for any of us in our jobs or our lives, you know, you can't. So that's a question of how much are we going to invest as a country in a solution of long-term problems, which would relate to supporting ongoing negotiations. Getting economic development and rebuilding and all that kind of, all those are issues related to this, I think. Do you think of any other ones?
Are there any religious issues involved at all? And would they fall by the wayside because we help them so many other ways?
That's a good point. I mean, what about the role of the Orthodox Church? I mean, I really have no idea, for example. I mean, we've had a pretty active dialogue as Lutherans, as the LCA, with Orthodox Church. Reading this book from 1964 paints a pretty grim, you know, just a few pages of it, a pretty grim picture of the role of the Orthodox Church in fostering intolerance in this area. That may have changed in the last 30 years to some degree, but it may not have changed as much as we might hope. What can the world community do to support the Orthodox? What can churches like ours do, especially that have pretty good relationships with some of the Eastern Orthodox churches, do to support their leadership in building, you know, tolerance and mutual understanding? I think that's a really good question, because that's a whole other group besides government and UN.
Mm-hmm. That's why I was kind of saying education, because those underlying animosities are there, there completely, and you can do all the aid and all the building up, and unless you can somehow do get some tolerance into the issue,
right,
by education or,
right,
I don't know.
And we all have the same intolerance.
That's right.
Towards, you know.
And Muslim and
Yeah, well, it's interesting, and I think, you know, this particular book from Time Life sort of paints the Muslims as sort of better on the tolerance issue than the Christians. You know, we may bristle at that, or, you know, but I mean, that's interesting. I think maybe the sort of partly it may well have to do with there being a minority. A lot of times, if you are a minority, this is true in various countries I've seen, where if you're used to living as sort of a minority within a larger culture,
sometimes you are more used to, you know, developing a style of life and communication that promotes harmony and tolerance because you benefit from that. I mean, you don't benefit from, you know, from intolerance. This is, the next one, declaration of war aims. What's interesting on this, I think we probably would all agree that it's really important prior to any, you know, escalation of military activity or undertaking of military activity for the aims to be really clearly stated what this is to accomplish. For example, you know, this is not to accomplish the retaking, they could say this is, you know, this is to enforce the peace agreement that has been made. That would be one aim. Compared to an aim of rolling back the Serbian gains. That would be another aim you could have, but, you know, to make it clear what you're going to do. Now, you remember in the Gulf War, Bush made it real clear that the aim was, we talked about this yesterday, to get the Iraqis out of Kuwait. And when that was accomplished, that was the end. Now, a lot of people say, well, you know, you should be going to, you know, bomb Baghdad, smithereens, get rid of the same. But that was not the stated aim of the military objective. And so, in that sense, and related to the Gulf War, even, you know, we may disagree with whether it was, you know, a last resort or justifiable cause, that this criteria of a clear declaration of aims and then that you go that far, that was accomplished, I think. Proportionality, that's this whole ends and means thing, you know. Mm-hmm. You cut off the nose to spite the face or whatever. You know, is what you will gain by this sufficient to justify the loss of life, the destruction of property, and all this kind of thing? And I think that's always a difficult one. When we look at Bosnia, there's already such destruction of life and such destruction of property that. I think, you know, maybe this isn't as big an issue. I don't think anybody's talking about dropping nuclear bombs on the Serbs. But this is something to be considered, you know, of how much, what level of force you use. We talked earlier about, you know, you go in there with everything you got, or do you go in with sort of a certain level that are related to carrying out your aims. Any thoughts about that?
Well, as long as the Russia has an equal voice in the UN, and they've been backing the Serb right along. I can't see how we can get the UN to go along with us bombing. I mean, it's been proposed and everything, but I don't see that the other countries are really for it.
Well, it's been agreed that...
As a threat,
right.
We haven't got to the point where they're actually going to do it.
That's because the Serbs did back down, you know, because they did remove all but a couple.
Well, I think that's the whole point.
Yeah.
And right. Maybe that will work.
Yeah.
Just making a threat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I read an article a couple of weeks ago, and it was comparing military people, and they were asking, you know, if they went in, what would happen? And one of them said the best they could hope for was an armistice. They could not force a peace.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I thought that was a pretty good statement.
Right.
He said long-standing things
right.
are not solved by going in and running over them and
right.
saying, you're going to do it this way. That
mm-hmm.
doesn't overcome hundreds of years of
that's right.
background.
Right.
And I thought that was a pretty good statement
yeah.
from the military people.
Right. An armistice, yeah.
And we should have learned from Korea. We still have an armistice after 40-some years.
Yeah, and we didn't get the long-term problems we saw there, yeah. I know we're sort of near the end of our time here, but this sixth one, we talked about this whole business of reasonable chance of success, and that's been a real stickler on this, about whether, you know, that. And sometimes we may say, you know, we may come to the point and say, well, this may have little chance of success, but the moral reasons for intervention are so compelling that we're going to sort of do it anyway. I mean, just because, and we think some of us have said that about Bosnia, that to stand by, you know, even if the chances are very small, it just feels like one, you know, can't do this.